Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Soleri Report. It is my great privilege and honor to bring back yet again one of my favorite people on the planet, Dr. Peter Bragan. Our discussion tonight is protecting your children from the weaponization of mental health. I was talking to Peter earlier and thought maybe we should call it predator evasion for parents. But Peter has a long history. He needs no introduction here, but of protecting children and people from the weaponization or abuse or misuse of mental illness and related pharmaceuticals. And you've seen him many times on the Soleri Report, but tonight we're going to focus just on what is happening and what is a scary increasing of the weaponization of mental health. So, Peter, welcome to the Soleri Report. And maybe if we could start a little bit with the history of this. This is an old tactic. It's been used many times throughout history. And in fact, you've dealt with it. You've fought it for many decades in the United States. So tell us a little bit about mental health as a political weapon and how we've seen it pop up in history before and in the United States as well.
Well, going back in history, the labeling of women as witches is probably the really explosion of the kind of mental health stuff that later developed. And there was an actual book of how to diagnose a witch, Malleus Maleficarum, something close to that. I haven't looked at that in a while. And it told you how a witch looks and acts and so on and so forth. And the idea there, of course, was to destroy dissenters. And in particular, they seem to go after women, the least powerful group in the world at the time. Right. And the DSM-4 and 5, now we have a 5TR, are a variation on the Malleus Maleficarum, which is how do we identify people that deserve to have a rain of fire descend on them in the form of drugs, but electroshock and then lobotomy, which I spent a good chunk of my early life fighting and to a great extent eliminating, but not 100%. So from the beginning, the use of identifying people as mentally ill has been abusive. It gets started within psychiatry when we have the Industrial Revolution, which brought wherever it was many, many people into the cities. The farms were taken over and expanded into other things. There was no place for the people in the villages, and we had street people. Like we're getting in LA now, all over Europe, and then later the United States. And this mostly occurs in the 1800s and the 1700s, and maybe a little earlier in France. And the idea was to be able to lock up people going around the criminal code. So it's civil commitment. Mm-hmm. And one of its origins was in the poverty laws, where you would be locked up for not paying money to somebody. And these were institutions were quite large. And then gradually they started to also contain the so-called mentally ill, who were being just scooped up and put into these giant facilities for the mentally ill. Essentially, it was like a very similar system between the poverty and the mentally ill. And today, well, we don't have so many big state hospitals, but when I was a young man at Harvard and volunteering in a major state mental hospital, the most common characteristic of the people was poverty, not even race, it was right. Poverty, and which means powerlessness. Oh, God, you're so good at that, about, learning to take care of yourself and getting wealth to the extent, protecting yourself and being able to live. So it's always been about how do we handle people we just are having trouble with or other people don't want.
To a certain extent, what you're describing is there's a managerial level of society. They change the economic model. It causes a huge people to become victim, and then they're targeted as mentally ill. Well, it's a way of targeting the victim.
It's very, very true. And by the time that was going on, there was already a counter-revolution of mostly Quaker institutions,
right,
the moral era of treatment, in which they treated the sickest of people among themselves, usually among the Quakers. And one of their principles, one of their books by Tuke, with us, it was a Tuke family who was very much involved, T-U-K-E, said, "We keep the doctors out." And they did religious teachings, they did health, they did good food. And if they got somebody who was like manic and totally out of control, instead of tying them up and putting them in seclusion, which we do now still, mm-hmm, they would bring a crowd of people around them to relate to them and engage them and get them under control.
Mm-hmm.
And a number of studies were done in retrospect, and they could not find that in any way the modern institutions, quote, had a better record with their drugs and shock treatment, which was very common then. It's still pretty common. That the human services were what mattered, the caring, right, the morals, the ethics, the Christian teachings. But these things die. They actually became incorporated into state mental hospitals.
Right.
And this is what they do all the time. They take something that's good and they either just squash it or they take it into the system and its validity disappears. So it's been a part of what you've always talked to me about the control mechanism.
Right.
And that there are these massive control mechanisms, hard to identify who these people are. We now call them the globalists. When did you first identify them? When did you first start to think of this as a global organization of control?
Honestly, when I was about 4 and a half.
God bless you. Well, I was about 80 and a half. Oh, God. And no wonder you were inspirational to me. You folks, Catherine Austin Fitz was one of the first people to make me go, "Oh, my God. What is this going on?" Because Ginger and I were looking at what we were finding beneath COVID-19, and it was way beyond my concept of the psychopharmaceutical complex, which I was probably the first person to talk about. And it was just huge. And today, let me take a little divergence. Today, I thought, let me review a few books because I haven't looked at this stuff in a long time. So I went back and I looked at our 1994 book, the War
Against... The one on kids?
Yeah,
yeah,
on kids. The War Against Children of Color. And it was about a eugenics program in the 1990s to go into the inner cities and to look for biological and genetic causes of why these little Black children, they call them inner city children, they threw in a few Hispanics probably, mm-hmm, why they were so violent. Well, this is classic eugenical assault. And they spoke openly about wanting to find better drugs for them, and they had pharmaceutical support. And they were about to go to Congress in a multi-agency plan. They had the FBI involved and, Justice Department involved. They had an IMH. They had everything you could possibly throw into this, and Peter and Ginger, starting with Ginger, because she was the one that said, "We're going to do something about this." I said, "I'm too busy." She said, "I've already been down to Congress." I was away at the time she got this rolling. Became a very long project. Well, I looked at it today, and the people supporting it were all the federal agencies, all the big research organizations, academic organizations, And I could have even then, if I'd had the you maybe talking to me, said, wait, this is so big. Everybody's supporting it. The Black Surgeon General is supporting it. Sullivan, what are these people doing? And I just couldn't get down to accepting what I now call the empires, that we right. human beings have lived under empires since time began. And I was reading Jeremiah night or two, and he was saying that God was promising to destroy all the kingdoms, and he starts naming all the kingdoms. This is well before birth of Christ. This right. is back, I don't know how many hundred years, but several hundred years, BC at least. And I mean, it just goes on and on, the list. And he's talking as if there are only empires. There aren't any free people. Mm-hmm. No people that aren't under empires. And I didn't have that concept, and very few people do. And we're writing about it. I'm particularly writing about it in our new book that I'm going to start talking about very soon.
So maybe I just have to interrupt you, because I wrote the book, Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, and I describe in it, at that time, in 1994, one of the deputy assistant secretaries of HUD describing it, that they'd given up on Black people and they were moving them out and moving in Hispanics. And what you're describing was part of what would create the air cover for that move out.
That's amazing.
Now you have to read my online book, Peter.
I'm gonna. I promise you within the week.
Okay.
Thankfully, I'm still very busy.
I know you're very busy.
People have, but you are the object of such veneration by me and Ginger that I better just go and read it.
Well, we're going to keep going because we got to get through history. So there is a long history of using these tactics to go after children in the United States. Am I not mistaken?
Yes, definitely. I think the big turning point, you know, the turning point for adults was Prozac. The turning point, and that's in 1989, 90, 91, and we talking back to Prozac in 94 and talk about children somewhat in it. But for the children, it's probably the late 60s, early 70s with Ritalin.
Right.
And they purposely created a diagnosis called ADHD first it began with brain disease, minimal brain disease, and they couldn't prove anybody who had any minimal brain disease. Then they went to hyperactivity, and that didn't cover enough people for drugs. You had to actually see the kid jumping around. So they went and they added to it the difficulties with concentration.
Right.
Now you got the girls in, the ones who were thinking, dreaming about, you know, getting married back in those days and what's their wedding dress going to be, or poetry or art, you know, and then just dreaming out the window. So they managed to encompass everything that would go wrong in a classroom. That became their strategy, was to define a disease that was actually anything that took the attention of the teachers.
Well, but the other thing is they were defining as a symptom things that were a symptom of what I call the great poisoning. So
yes.
The deterioration of the food system, the global spraying, the EMF radiation, you know, pharmaceuticals. You have all these things that are causing the toxicity levels to go up, or the, you know, the monkey mind to go up, so the media. And you're doing all these kids that cause kids to be more difficult to manage in a classroom.
Yeah. Yeah, so the child's brain and body is compromised. And now, interestingly enough, see, Ginger was thinking about these things, but I wasn't even thinking about these things. You know, doing psychotherapy rather than psychiatry. I mean, I'm a psychiatrist, but I talk to people. I didn't quite get into that. And I do see that now as a part of this whole group, because it's always the same kinds of people, whether it's the chemical companies or the pharmaceutical companies.
Right.
I didn't realize where the DOD was so involved in, you know, horrible experiments and bad outcomes for people. But yes, it was a part of also the destruction of the family. I mean, what makes it hardest for a child to leave home effectively is not being disciplined and loved at the same time in the home. So the child goes out without a secure base and begins to be hyperactive in the schools, or not paying attention, or just being a normal child. I mean, many, many of these children were perfectly normal. The basic original research, they simply took the reports of teachers, and they then went and asked the parents, and the parents agreed to trying the medication on even when they didn't even see anything the matter with their kids. I mean, that's how much this came down through the system onto the kids, onto the parents. From the beginning, it was a concocted money-making control mechanism,
right?
Which at the time I wasn't thinking of the giant, so much of the giant control. It sounded fabricated, conspiratorial to me, and I didn't want it to detract from this horrible data that I was working on about how destructive the drugs are to the kids.
Right.
And by the way, this is very parallel to COVID-19 and the rejection of the things that really help children, which are improved teaching, improved parenting, and the imposition of poisonous substances on the children. It's very parallel to the vaccines.
One of the things I want to talk about, we're going to go to talk about sort of all the different players who might cause trouble to a child or a family this way. But first, I want to say we have two general fact patterns. One fact pattern is a kid's fine, and yet in the environment, there is a machinery that creates false allegations related to that kid. So the kid's perfectly fine, or just being a kid. Mm-hmm. And the environment.
Or the youngest in the class, because that's a very major characteristic of these kids.
But these allegations are manufactured and trouble comes.
Yes.
The other fact pattern is something is happening in the environment that causes real distress, like COVID-19 and the lockdowns. And then the child reacts to the distress in what I would describe as a healthy way. They don't like it. And then bam, comes the machinery saying they're, you know, it's blame the victim. And, but you, you know, so there's a, you know, so they're hooking onto some behavior that in fact it's W.C. Fields and the snake potion. They got the snake potion, but they also had sent in the snake. Right?
Yeah.
Right.
I think it's a very good point. Blaming the victim covers a lot of this. A lot of this is victim control or suppression. Or destruction.
Right. Right. But it's very sophisticated and very clever. Okay, so let's turn to the players, because I think the challenging thing for a parent is to understand all the different directions this can come from. So I want to start out with, of course, our favorite, the schools and colleges. Because this started, I'll tell you when this started for me, Peter. I was driving somewhere to see and I stopped on the way to have dinner with a lovely subscriber, just the loveliest person in the world. And she's a teacher and just a lovely, you know, I'm sure she's a fabulous teacher. And we had dinner, just the two of us, and she speaks in a very low voice and she said, I need to tell you something, but you cannot, you know, this is totally secret. You cannot tell anybody. And she said, we are required to give surveys to the children about sex and mental health, which are completely outrageous. And we are not allowed to tell the parents that we're giving it to them.
Oh my.
And we are required to teach the children to not tell the parents. And if it is discovered that I'm telling you about this, I could be fired because I'm not allowed to tell anybody about this. But these surveys are shocking and frightening. But what I can tell you is there's some brave soul in Massachusetts who put a copy of the survey we're using up on the internet. Here's, she had written out the URL so I could go find it without her having to email it to me. So I did, and I put it up, and it was unbelievable. I mean, it was so invasive, and it was suggesting things to children, you know, it was trying to put ideas in their mind and you know, and create problems that didn't exist is the only way I can describe it. But it was deeply invasive.
What so, year is this roughly?
This was, say, 2015.
Oh, okay. So it's part of the new surge, yeah.
Yeah, it was a new surge. And but I, you know, what shocked me was the extent they had gone to terrorize the teachers and the kids to make sure the parents mm-hmm. couldn't find out.
Yeah, and how uniform the response is. This is another shocking part of human beings, how quickly they get scared into conformity.
Well, so but they are trying to collect unbelievably invasive information that they can then use to make up some kind of mental health problem that doesn't exist. I mean, it's very shocking.
Yeah, mine, I think it goes into the destruction of the family, too, because this right. is the schools now become the parent, and the parents are disenfranchised. They don't even know what's happening to their kids.
So they're disenfranchised in terms of control. They're not disenfranchised in terms of expense. They're still liable for everything their child does. Or if the school gives the child a pharmaceutical or an injection without the parent's permission, if there's an adverse event, the parents are financially liable.
Yeah.
Right.
It's really true. You're so good at that. You see, and I wasn't even thinking that broadly.
They disenfranchise the assets, mm-hmm. but not the liabilities.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So we have the schools and colleges intervening in these ways. So let me turn to employers, including because, you know, kids can work in the summers or after school. I just got an email from a subscriber whose company is designating various people around the firm as MHFAs, mental health friends and something. I don't know. But they're designated to identify that you need mental health help or you may have a mental health problem. So you have people sprinkled all over the company who
snitches.
At any point, it's snitches, busybody. They're appointing busybodies.
Karens.
Who in fact, Karens, there you go. Now, remember, this could be, you know, you could arrive at work unhappy about what happened to your kid. You could tell one of your coworkers the trouble you're having your kid. They turn it into your employer. And the next thing you know, this person has designated your kid as having a mental health problem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it can come from the employers. Family and friends. You know, I hate to say it. We all have people in our family who are dangerous. No, really, I have one person in my family I haven't talked to since 2006.
I concluded that when I was 4 years old.
There you go.
It made very, very clear to me that for some reason I could not trust the people around me. And right. that's when I, you know, I was raised by my black child mother, the 16-year-old to 20-year-old, and I then they made her go away when they realized that I loved her and not them.
Right.
So from then on, just as you had this perspective at four, it's so interesting about the something big and global going on, I guess. And I came into white society very, very unsure and suspicious of what I was seeing, even though I was very successful. I was incredibly right. successful as a child.
Well, you must have loved to learn. You must have just loved to learn.
I love to learn, but on another level than the school was teaching. That also became clear fairly early.
So let me explain what I predict happened, because this is what happened to me. When I was in business in Washington, I was a great believer in different tests like Myers-Briggs to help you build teams, mm-hmm. because it taught you a lot about how people process information and problems, and it would be very good in helping you build up teams. So you wanted balance in your teams according to their profiles. And one of the tests, and I forget what it was called, you could be abstract or concrete, and you could be relational or sequential. And I remember when someone taught me the test, sort of an industrial psychologist or human resource person, what they said was that 70% of the American people were concrete sequential.
Mm-hmm.
It was the most common. And the American school system was set up for concrete sequentials. So I'm an abstract relational, and putting me in a concrete sequential learning curriculum will certifiably, you know, I can't adjust. I cannot adjust. And so my guess is you're probably not concrete sequential.
No, this is called, I'm trying to remember the exact division in the actual test, but yes, that's right. And it's a relatively small percentage of people who are trying to see the big picture.
Right.
And that's the abstract is the big picture.
Right.
And that's what always interested me. And fortunately, I had access to the books that my brother, who was 4 years older, when he came home from college on one occasion, and I think he didn't continue that year or something, and he left up like books of all kinds. And one of them was actually, I don't know how we got this in a public college, university, but one of them was the Catholic view of life.
Oh, well, really?
Yeah, it was by a Jesuit. And that was like, I never heard anything like this before. I mean, this was like, another was this, well, I'm not sure if it's by Spinoza. I got all these different books very early, and they were far more interesting than what was being taught in the school. And that was very unusual for a youngster in those years to have, you know, independent sources.
Okay,
but yeah, all right, enough about us.
So let me go back. So then you have the community. You have neighbors, and there are a few kind of players that can be in a neighborhood which are dangerous. One is snitches, who are paid to snitch.
Mm-hmm.
One is groomers, who are also mm-hmm. paid to groom, you know,
mm-hmm.
Literally paid to turn your kid into, you know, something other than what they would normally become. And the other is what I call economic hitmen. So, you know, you may have a group of people out within your community who are not trustworthy for many different reasons. And that also, I have to add, you have social workers who can be teamed up and paying some of these people or encouraging some of these people because they want to get your, you know, their hands on your family or your kids or both.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And this is fairly new that this is so extreme. I remember there's always been the idea of don't talk to strangers and don't go into somebody else's car when you're little.
Right.
But this level of when the teacher tells you not to tell your parents, that's when you tell your parents.
Right.
That's a whole new level of trying to educate children. I think it's incredibly important for children to feel loved at home.
Right.
While they also know there are disciplinary limits to how you treat other people.
Right.
You know, and yourself, that you have to treat yourself and other people in a kind way. And if they're near to you, dear to you, in a loving way. But that the wider world now has become so dangerous. And I think one of the reasons why we have such a spurt in the homeschooling is because parents are realizing that's actually pretty tall order.
Right.
How do you teach people that God plays an important part in life when you never hear about him at all? It's illegal in the schools.
Right.
It's the opposite of the government shall not interfere in religion. It's government shall crush religion. God, that's a real mind bender. How they turned around that concept of freedom of religion, and I think it's a tough question: is how do you deal with this? But I think in large part it's separating your child from the start from the system, because peers and other people become more important than parents in the system.
So, but if you're a single parent and you don't have the resources to homeschool, what do you do?
Well, I think you really, even though you're overburdened, you got to put a lot of time aside for your child.
Right.
You got to give the basis of the loving relationship that will sustain your child and make them believe they can tell you something like, "Mommy, something funny happened in school today."
Well, it was I just got an email from someone who said apparently Florida has outlawed certain kinds of psychology, but his granddaughter was going to FSU, Florida State University, and explained in her class that is now outlawed, she'd been introduced to 48 genders. There are 48 genders.
Oh, my God. God preserve, save us. We need God. We need a real big intervention to balance off against the schools.
Okay, so let me keep going around players. You also
let me slow down a minute, because you've brought up a way of thinking, as you often do, that I have not explored inside myself. That is a good way to look at things. One of the keys is to help your child not accept any abuse. Any. And I don't think I thought this way when I was raising my kids decades and decades ago. But one of the most important things in what I teach as a psychotherapist in my practice, and I'm still in practice, folks. I mean, understand that. They didn't get me. I'm still in practice. One of the most important things for an adult or a child to learn is that no one should do something to you that makes you uncomfortable. You have the right to not sit there and take it.
Right.
And I had that idea from Bessie, because she actually, it's so interesting. She was—
Now, Bessie is your daughter?
No, that's the black child that raised me.
Ah, okay.
And she would jump up and protect me if my parents started to do something, like it'd be a little mean. She would let me know that it was okay to really protect myself against my big brother. And I did.
Mm-hmm.
And she set up the idea that we have to protect ourselves.
There are boundaries, and we have the right to protect our boundaries.
Boundaries, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, including my brother stepping on my trains.
That's right.
Boundaries.
Right.
And it's good to let your children know real specifically that if somebody's bullying them in school, no matter who it is, that they should talk to you about it. Not necessarily, I had to handle it on my own, because when Bessie was gone, there was nobody there to back up, really, but only most minimally. So that they can come to you. If the teacher does something uncomfortable or hands out something uncomfortable to you, I think we have to do that now with our kids.
Right.
It's the same thing as don't talk to strangers on the street.
But how do you get your child to understand how— I mean, first you've got to explain to your child or help your child understand that not all, you know, you can trust some adults and you can't trust others. So there are adults who are not trustworthy with respect to some things or all things. You know, it's a range. But how do you get them to understand that some adults cannot be trusted and they have to protect themselves without making them scared, without making them paranoid, without making them, you know, see, you know, get in their imagination that they're seeing something going wrong that's not? In other words, how do you keep them grounded while you get them trained to deal with this?
Well, I think first of all, whether somebody becomes paranoid and frightened in that manner will be determined more how you, the mother or the father or the big brother or big sister, relates to them than what you tell them.
So you having confidence in them.
Yes,
and, they
and in
can
the world,
do this.
Right. And in handling the world. So if you're not freaked out when you're saying it, but if you're looking at your child and shaking and saying you can't do that and communicating overwhelm and fear.
Right.
So you always want to communicate to your child that they have sovereignty, that,
right.
that they have control, that they can handle things, and you want to help them handle them.
Right.
And there are some things they definitely need to bring home to mom and dad because you're their backup.
Right.
And that's just very, very key. And
so I think helping the whole family see the family as people who have each other's back.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's right.
Right. So part of our family is we back each other up. We have each other's back. We can count on each other.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. And at the same time, communicating to them that within their limits as children, they can handle things. They can come home and say something about what the teacher's been doing or what the big bully has been doing or what the priest has been doing. God, right. we haven't thought about that terrible scandal that still goes on. What the coach is doing. When you go on a school trip, don't let anybody touch your body.
Right.
You can say aloud no. But I think these are very difficult things, and I don't want to be too facile on the air. But the real thing that matters, and this is so important, mom and dad, is you.
Right.
When I help children who are preteen and even in the early teens, I often see them once or twice, and the rest is with me and the parents, teaching them to dare to be more loving and dare to be set more limits.
Mm-hmm.
And that strength you're giving the child is going to be the center.
Right. Right. And if the child sees you saying no to people and holding your boundaries
yes.
up against other people.
Yes.
That's
yes.
very important for them to see. Okay. Yeah. So let me just finish on the players, because one of the most troublesome group of players is not the ones we've talked about so far. It's the online players.
Yeah.
So the online players are, first of all, some of them are using entrainment technology and neurological weaponry to attract, induce, trick. And these kids are up against 21st century weaponry, and they don't even know it exists. So that's problem number one. But problem number two, online you have groomers, you have surveillance, and then you have all sorts of people collecting and delivering media. And media can be, including, you know, movies and TV yeah. shows, can be very brainwashing.
Yes, yes. Ginger and I had a very interesting example of this. We were watching a movie last night, which is, I think, the most recent one about making the monster, getting the genetics of the dinosaurs. What is that series called? And Jurassic Park series.
Right.
And it's all about one more series in this. And Ginger and I were looking for what is the subtle message here? Okay. I mean, these movies, she believes very strongly, and I'm beginning to think, have a lot of built-in propaganda that they
have subliminals.
So they've got all kinds of subliminals and they're preparing us for something. So which how she looks at it. And there's a little girl in the movie, a grandchild of one of the men who feels very badly about what he's done to originate all this and how bad it was. And she plays a very sweet part in the movie. And very near the end of the movie, the bad guy says, "And you're a monster too. You were cloned by your grandfather from his wife when she died."
Oh my God.
And she's so sweet. The clone is such a sweet human being. And I thought of that. I probably woke up in the middle of the night. That's the message, the getting ready to clone children.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, one of the reasons that you would reduce fertility is, you know, you want to control the genes that come into the world, and mm-hmm. you think you can have babies in incubators, right?
Yeah. Yes, yes. But how do you prepare children to do what took me a bit of time after the movie even to see that what was the really new remarkable thing? Oh, we had a cloned beautiful child in the movie who's brave and loving. And the kid's only about five, women. I'd say seven.
Well, but they keep thinking that humans are like just simply material beings. And it's beyond strange. Okay. So one of the things you do is you try and limit your child's school to something which is healthy, whether it's homeschooling or certain kind. You know, people are creating lots of school. There's schools springing up everywhere. But another thing is you need to be very careful about who you allow them to associate with.
Absolutely. And you teach them that. If they bring home a kid as a friend who doesn't talk to them respectfully, you've got to teach your children to protect themselves personally, socially. It's astonishing just on the personal level how many really good children end up going out with and having sex with really not nice people. Right. It's a major theme in therapy of these early experiences. But one of the reasons people do that is that they haven't learned in their dealings with their mother and father that they're treasures. Right. So I think if you could teach your child that she's made in God's image, which I did not. I was an agnostic when I was the years of mm-hmm. raising my kids, probably. I believed in God up until I figured out that praying to win races didn't make sense. Why should I pray to God that I win the race and not somebody else? And that just overturned everything for me. I had such a primitive. I was just working on my own on these issues. I didn't have anybody to talk to about them. But it's just so important. If your child can believe they're a treasure, mm-hmm. that they're a gift from God, then...
that they're wholly unique.
Yeah, they're unique and holy in two ways, holy in the whole and holy in the spiritual way. They're going to be a lot better at recognizing immediately that on a first date, when the boy reaches across and takes your hand without your permission and holds on to it and you don't know what to do, that's an abuse.
Right.
That to look for the subtle abuses, I think that we need to do that. Our children are too victimized by so many different forces. But again, it comes down to, it's so important, it's so basic to everything I believe, think, and teach and help people with in therapy, is that you have inherent worth. You do not need to say mean things to yourself all day long. You can open your heart to being loved by God, and sometimes we'll find that little moments in time when they were loved by their parents or loved by an aunt or an uncle. Or for me, you know, it was this child growing into womanhood mm-hmm. Who was taking care of me. The whole key is treasuring yourself and your child. And parents are afraid of being proud of their kids. They're afraid of being loving to their kids. They don't want to spoil their kids. No, the only way...
Well, you can't spoil a child by loving them too much. There's no such thing as spoiling a child with too much love.
No, no. Not unless you don't have boundaries on your love.
Right.
So your love has to have boundaries on it. And you have to be very aware of what makes your child uncomfortable. And teach them that you don't want to do things that make them uncomfortable and you're sorry you did.
But you also need to provide discipline.
That's right. They have to learn to treat other people as treasures. That's what it's all about, folks.
Right, exactly.
Oh, God.
So
it's pretty simple in some ways, but they're making it really complicated. And you are such a gift in letting people know how complicated it is, and that this is global, and this is...
Well, here's what's important to understand, is that you are surrounded by a large number of people, and within that group, there are people who are mind-controlled or incentivized to harm your children.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they might not think of it that way, but we haven't talked about doctors yet, so we've gone through online. So let's talk about doctors, because now, I've never known a parent who didn't have a child between the ages of, being born and turning 21 that didn't need some kind of medical care at some point.
Right.
So, you know, we tend to break our legs and have sports injuries and everything else. How do you now find doctors who don't play this trick? And so let me just tell a story. And I think I've told you this story before. I wanted to see a doctor. I was out in California working, and I just felt tired all the time. And it was purely physical, and it wasn't like me, because normally I have tremendous physical energy.
Right.
And I thought, well, maybe it's hormones, because I'm at that age. It could be, maybe I should be taking hormones. So I really studied and checked references and really researched who was really good. And I found a doctor who got incredible references. I walk in to see her, and Peter, she was the strangest person I've ever dealt with. I don't know who had threatened her or what had happened. And I sit down and I start to talk to her, and she says, "Are you depressed?" I said, "No, I'm not depressed, but I'm tired. I just feel tired." Literally within 30 seconds, she says to me again, "Are you depressed?" She asked me 8 times if I was depressed. On the 8th time, I said, "Let me ask you something. Are you depressed? And is that why you're asking me if I'm depressed? Because she was acting depressed, And she got really angry and almost kicked me out of the office. I should have just stood up and walked out, because whatever was going on, somebody had put her up to this, and it wasn't nice. And she was scared and wasn't making a whole lot of sense. And it was, she was trying to get me to say that I was depressed. And I just absolutely...
Maybe she was literally incentivized by the drug companies.
No, I think this one was a unique for Catherine. I normally wouldn't say that. I normally would just say it was the drug companies. But she was so uptight and scared.
Yeah.
That I think it was something...
Well, we do tend to project onto other people, whether we're a doctor or not.
Right. And, there are many different fact patterns of what it could be, but how do you
this is a great example, which is that you have to be able to care enough about yourself. And I don't even use love when I talk about what we need to do for ourselves. I mean, love is something we give to the world. I don't know how we quite would give love to ourselves. It's always puzzled me. But you have to think enough of your own personal value as a human being that when somebody makes you uncomfortable, like this woman did with you, that you have the right to simply say, "I'm sorry, I'm not comfortable," and get up and leave. It's very hard to do. It's hard for me as a doctor to
it was hard for me because I had invested a huge amount of money and time in getting to this point, and I was looking for a certain amount of information, which I believe she had based on her references.
Right.
And I hated to come all this way without getting what I came to get.
It has to start with somebody caring about us.
Right.
And they went after my medical license back in the 80s because I said on Oprah Winfrey that she asked me in the last 30 seconds of a show, and I felt I had real rapport with her. She was a very different person back then and in the 80s. And I had talked to her in the green room about that what psychiatrists were missing was spirituality, because I knew she believed in that. And I said, "They don't have spirituality. It's all materialistic. It's all about your brain and drugs." She's like, "Really? They don't think about the human spirit?" I said, "No, they don't know." But that was like a 30 second. So we came to the end of the show, and she said to me, tell us, doctor, what do you do? God, it's so set for this. She said, what do you do if you go to a doctor for the first time and they offer you a medication? A psychiatrist, or you think is a therapist or somebody. And I said, Oprah, if the person doesn't make you feel worthwhile when you meet them, and instead they give you a prescription, put it in your pocket, thank them very much, do not raise your voice or protest because it's not safe with a psychiatrist, simply leave and find somebody who cares about you and that makes you feel better than when you walk in the office.
Wow, and they went after your license for that?
Yes. Ugh. And on Oprah, no less.
So you know it was a perfect answer.
I've had the gift under stress to see and to respond. It's really interesting. But they didn't think it was perfect. The American Psychiatric Association demanded of Oprah that she let the American Psychiatric Association give a rebuttal to Dr. Bregan. And this is probably was the real key to why they went after me. I was going to say sued me, but they didn't. They went after my license. Oprah said, I will have your president come on, providing Dr. Bregan comes on for a discussion. This is amazing. Nobody.
And they wouldn't do it.
Oh, they did.
They did. And you went on?
I went on with the president of the American Psychiatric Association. His name aptly was Fink, F-I-N-K. And we each were supposed to bring a patient, a mental patient. So they brought somebody there with funding, literally funding. And I brought, oh God, she's gone now, a wonderful woman named Judy, who was a professor of rehabilitation at a university and who was never my patient and whose only experience as a patient was being locked up in a mental hospital as a child.
Right.
So it was a humiliation for the Psychiatric Association. And the president was practically trembling at the end and saying this is that he didn't have to be cross-examined. This wasn't a law room or courtroom or something. I wasn't mean. I was just
clear.
At one point, quoting from one of the APA publications that was agreeing with me about something, which I knew he would lie about. But
okay,
so you know, yes, treat yourself like a treasure. Don't let anyone make you or your children uncomfortable.
Okay, now how do you teach your child that online systems and media may include things like entrainment and subliminal programming and these kinds of techniques, and that some of the adults or children they're dealing with are subject to these things?
I think you do it very gently and very carefully, and you set limits. I think that it's so hard, though. Again, I don't want to make believe this is easy. I think you absolutely must set limits on the amount of time your child spends exposed to things.
Right.
And unlike I would have said years ago, where, you know, respect your child's autonomy completely or as much as you can, I think you have to actually make sure it's that they're not using these instruments. You could tell them they're poisonous.
Right. The successful parents I know keep all that stuff out of the house.
Yeah.
And they keep their kids out in nature. They're in the forest.
Yeah, well,
they're
skiing. That's wonderful.
They're swimming. They're playing soccer. They're out, you know, they're out in nature all the time. And they love it, you know, because they're having fantastic experiences in nature all the time.
I think that that's very, very important. Anything you do with your child where you're connected to them and they are protected from the electronic universe around them, I think is really important. I think you said that very well. And I think you do have to do whatever you need to do to keep them away from this stuff. There are plenty of kids now who are being, not now, I'm talking about a little earlier, who were raised without TV before the issues were so broad.
Right. Right.
And I think you got to raise your children without a lot of things they might want and set limits on them.
So one of the most tragic things I saw during the pandemic was kids wanted to be with their friends. And they would risk their lives and take all the injections so they could be with their friends. And literally the kids couldn't stop them because they could go out and get the injections without your permission.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, and to me, that's why you have to be really careful about what friends you allow grow into your child's life. Because the next thing you know, the friends are dragging them across the line and getting them killed.
Yeah, I mean, all this is real. There's there's no simple way, but the more you're an involved parent, the more you're actually spending time every weekend with your children, doing something fun, and sometimes in the evenings, the more that you are partially a friend as well as a parent, and that you love them and they love you, and that's an acknowledged reality, the more they're just going to come to you about issues. But it's a big problem.
Okay, so last question. You know, in our Building Wealth curriculum, the second pillar is called Navigation Tools. And the way I introduce it is I say there's official reality and then there's reality. Mm-hmm. Official reality is for the cocktail party, and reality is for your investments and risk management. So you don't use reality at the cocktail party where it's not welcome, and you don't use official reality for your investments where, you know, which will cause you to lose all your money. Mr. Global will harvest you. And you need to have a clear picture of both to navigate society. I mean, I wish it weren't so, but you do need to know what the official reality is because you need to navigate it. How do you explain to a child that there are these, you know, these two parallel universes, one called reality and one called fake reality, and they have to be able to not only know both, but to navigate, to know which world they're in? So I'll give you a perfect example. When I was a little, I grew up in a very multicultural situation between school, society, and where I lived. And I had a system where essentially my world had three cultures in it, and I would look at your shoes and I would know which culture I was in, so which version of pretzel talk I would talk. You know, there were three different official realities, and I could tell by your shoes which official reality I was in, and that's how I navigated. No, literally.
That's wonderful. So much starts so young for some of us.
Right. So I just started early with the multiple personality, you know, multicultural. It was real multicultural, mm-hmm. You know, because they were different planets. They were different realities. How do you teach a child that, you know, when you're home at the dinner table and we're talking about reality, that you don't bring that up at school? You know, you may, if you go, you know, you don't want to bring that up with a social worker because, you know, home is for, when we talk about reality, that's a different reality than the official reality you may have to use in these other situations.
Well, I don't think there's, again, an easy solution. I think you start with the basis that you have a loving family. That's the whole starting key. You have a loving family that is also has respect. So when I deal with parents and how they're going to relate to their kids, I say, first thing you got to do is relate respectfully. So I'm going to teach you how to set limits. We're going to work on that always with respect for your child. Always. There's no losing your temper. There's no, oh, if I can't hit my children, who can I hit kind of attitude that, and stuff. If I can't scream at my children, who can I? And you really have to love your kids. You really have to love them and teach them. And it's a broad teaching. I don't think the issue is about a specific of these things as much as it's about you arm your child with helping them understand that they may not learn this in the world, but they're a treasure. And anything in that outside world that takes advantage of you or teaches you or tries to tell you you're not a treasure or you're crazy or you're mentally ill or girls can't do this or boys are supposed to do that or whatever, you right. come back to the fact that you're a treasure. And I think that only some that kind of profound learning on the child's part eventually protects them. And I think that ultimately the first 5 years I had from a child who couldn't perhaps have participated in any kind of conversation like this. I met her many years later. She was working for some family members. She was not, she was not what I got as a child from her as a child.
Right.
And what I got was thinking that I should be well taken care of and loved.
So one last thing I do want to say is, you know, protecting your child from what I call the great poisoning and teaching your child how to protect themselves from the great poisoning, you know, that is very important predator evasion that every child needs to learn.
They really have to learn that there are loving families and loving friendships, but you have to be on the lookout. And, right. you know, we've been elaborating, and you're really an advanced thinker on all these issues, but what comes after your kid, we may not have even thought of. So
right.
it's really about arming your child. I give you that phrase. It's about arming your child with a sense of self-respect and love for others that protects them from being abused by whatever abuse comes along. So, and I think it's fine to talk about, depending on what your child's interested in or able to talk about, what some specific dangers may be. But you also just let them know, my God, don't hide from us something somebody tells you you're supposed to. And some basic ideas like that.
So the one other thing I would mention is I've known colleagues or young people who say they had trouble with bullies or various things, and their parents got them into martial arts. And martial arts really does teach you how to defend your boundaries.
Yes.
And to have confidence in your ability to protect yourself. You know, it's
yes.
a discipline, and it gets you, you know, and it is focused on defense. So it's not an offensive sport. So I think there are things you can do physically, sports, martial arts, things to help, you know, to help children learn physical predator evasion. But that concept then gives them a framework for, you know, more energetic or information kind of invasion.
I think so. I was involved in athletics as a kid. I played football at my size, ran track, and I certainly learned a lot about life and defending myself. And I carried into it that lesson that Bessie gave me in respect to my whole
right.
family, which is nobody can hurt you or bully you. You know, they can hurt
yeah.
you and under the rules, but not when they break the rules. That's how I interpreted it.
Well, I think what I'm hearing from you is you've got to budget and make time.
Oh, God, yes. And I do that on the first day with people. I'll be sitting there with a, quote, ADHD boy who I'm one of the most serious kids I ever saw. And they're not ADHD. I mean, this was a child who was hallucinating and trying to hide behind the couch. I finally got him out from behind the couch and so on. And one of the things I asked right away was, when did you last go out with your dad on a weekend to do something together? And his father answered, he always says no. And the little boy didn't answer. And I said, would you like to do something fun with your dad that maybe you picked? He said, oh, yeah. And I said, he did this. He budgeted time. It's a good word for it because you have to do it. He budgeted time every weekend with his child.
Right.
And then we talked about mom and what she could do. And there were other children in the family, and that she had to start doing something with everybody now. But these were very honorable parents. And they were just very, very busy professional people, and particularly when this child was growing up. And that child, by the way, who was, I mean, that child has done fabulously and now is a way grown adult, doing well out in the world. But the work with the parents was to pay attention, to love them, to not overreact, to make them a very top priority. I said, you know, some people make their children the top priority.
Right.
I said, I don't know that I did that. And I was a young professional like you. But the nearer we come to it, the more they're going to feel like they matter and they're loved and they're going to get seen. And I only saw the boy once or twice, I told him in the first or second session that, and I do this with all the kids, I said, and listen, I'm going to say this in front of your parents. Even if they blow it, it's your life at stake. You have to learn, stop hitting people. You have to believe you can actually learn and do well in school. So I teach the autonomy right away. And I think that also makes clear to the parents.
Tim Caban, who helps me with the equity overview, just sent me a study that was demonstrating that the greatest cause of sort of life satisfaction was a sense of autonomy. And I thought that was, you know, it resonates with what you're saying about a child needing and wanting to learn autonomy.
Yes, I think that it's a profound satisfaction to know that you control yourself as much as you can and your life as much as you can, and to feel you're making the choices, not somebody else. I think that's a profound source of satisfaction. And I would label that self-esteem. But the deepest, I think, satisfaction, which may not be measurable on a test, is the belief that you deserve to have love and to give love.
Right.
Because what wrecks people the most is not a business failure. It's a feeling of they don't deserve to be loved. And right. They got it in childhood almost every time.
Right.
Made worse by traumas later on. So I would say those two things, being autonomous and then believing you deserve love. And why do you deserve love? Well, it's awfully helpful to believe you're made in the image of God, in God's image, and you're a treasure, and so, you deserve love.
So here you're a parent, and you know that there are people out in the world who are literally trying to kill or steal your children or corrupt them.
Yeah.
But, you know, part of it is putting up the, I don't know, putting up the defense so that within the home you can have a loving, you know, it's like being in a war zone, except you've got a loving home, but you're prepared to put out the shield, you know, and go outside and deal with it. So I want to end with a story that I think I may have told you once, but I want to tell it again. Someone, when I first got to Tennessee, wanted me to listen to a cassette of their favorite preacher. So I listened to it. And it started out as follows. It's the young man, the preacher, had graduated from seminary and was assigned to his first church and had to give his first sermon at his new church. And he decided he wanted to teach on faith. And he thought, well, who in my life have I ever known who demonstrated the condition or the characteristic of perfect faith? And he realized his mother had raised him and his two siblings in the middle of the Depression without a husband. And he never remembered seeing her afraid or angry, even though financially they were in devastating circumstances and, you know, struggling against all odds. So he called his mother and said, you know, I'm working on the sermon. And I thought, you know, who has the most perfect faith? And I realized I never once saw you afraid or unhappy. You were always, you know, it was a loving household despite everything going on, you know, outside the home. But in the home, it was a perfect loving. How did you do that? How did you have that kind of perfect faith? Mm-hmm. And she said, well, son, and she thought and thought and thought. And she said, that was before psychology.
Oh, Well, I'm afraid that that's true to a great extent, that psychology has undermined us.
Well, but psychology has been used to get the victim embroiled in a whole drama.
That's more specific. That's right.
That has nothing to do with jumping the curve against the predator. In other words, so John Rappaport has this wonderful thing called Here Come the Grief Counselors about Columbine, where when everybody started to say, what happened? Who were the shooters? What really went down here? You know, suddenly they would be inundated with grief counselors who wanted to talk to you about your grief.
Yeah.
You know, so instead of figuring out what had happened that harmed you and your children, you're instead talking about your belly button and going no place, right?
Yeah.
So it's a way of embroiling the victims in a drama that get them no place.
Yes, and grief counseling, I think that a person could do good grief counseling.
Yeah.
But it has to emphasize overcoming what you've been through. It has to be, it starts with autonomy. And the first thing I would do, I do with people who are feeling overwhelmed and sad and tragic, is I address their ability as a human being to overcome it. And then they deny it, and then we begin working. Because if you don't have the autonomy first, you can't do the work.
That is such a brilliant insight, Peter.
It's the basis of what I do. For example, if I'm doing drug withdrawal, I make sure that the person's brain is working well enough to actually approach any issues autonomously. Because if they can't, then we have to focus down on, hey, you're not able to think very clearly right now, so we're not going to go back into childhood or anything right now. Let me help you get off the drugs so that you're somewhat into it before we start talking more seriously, because the drugs rob your autonomy. And
so the first thing a parent has to do is to recognize that they have the ability and power to raise their children successfully in this environment and help them learn over time to emerge as an adult with successful predator evasion skills.
But with autonomy and a loving family, I don't think they have to talk a lot about evasion so much as about anything that bothers you. And I'm going to help you by taking away.
Well, but here's what they need to do.
Stuff.
They need the ability to filter the integrity of another person.
Yes, that I think is a really good thing.
And they need to learn, you know, you meet a person and you don't let them all the way in day one. They have to run through a filter and be tested and tried and make sure, you know, that there is not only alignment, but there is, you know, they operate to a certain standard. So
I think that's really, really true. But it's hard to do, but it's really, really, really true.
Right.
I'll leave you with a story from an uncle of mine who went through the war. It was not a nice man. He was actually an abuser. He's gone now of his wife. But I had a dog I loved dearly who was just the size of almost a Great Dane. And I was out in the back with my Uncle Dutch. He was the same. And the dog, our dog, jumped the back fence and got his foot in the fence and totally twisted into what looked like a terrible position. And I screamed. And the soldier and my uncle said, you don't do that. We're going to go over and extricate him. You don't lose control and scream.
Right.
And that's what we did. We went over and we helped our dog foot out of the fence, and he was fine. Thank goodness. So I got one or two lessons that really got emblazoned on being under control at the proper time.
Right.
Remember that, folks, and make a huge difference. Don't ever give up your autonomy, your power, your self-control. You actually can learn to control your emotions with ethics and principles. You can actually learn to do that.
Right. That's great advice, Peter.
It's amazing to talk with you. I mean, it's so seldom that I'm on the air and being asked questions I don't know. It's not just seldom. It never happens as it does with you, because you get to the crux and I have to think. And meanwhile, in the background, I'm thinking, oh, God, I wish I'd had all this straighter when I was raising my kids.
Well, here's the thing. We keep learning. And it's always, you know, it would be great to have had it way back then. But this is how we learn.
And I've given it to many families and their children. So that's
good. Okay. Well, Peter Bregan, a wealth of history, knowledge. We're going to put up links to your websites and materials. We also did some collections back when you and I were first talking about the weaponization of mental health with, you know, some historical examples from the Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, or, you know, through history. Because as you said, you know, the witch trials, this is a game that's been going on for a long, long, long time.
Yes, it has.
Yeah. And, you know, our prayer is that you will navigate it with amusement and with love and not be, you know, not fall prey to it. So anyway, with that, Peter, thank you very much. Give Ginger my love. Have a wonderful evening. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on the Solari Report. Always a pleasure.